I'd like to let you know that Aussie Meter is sponsored by OPC Health, an Australian supplier of prosthetics, orthotics, clinic equipment, compression garments, rehabilitation devices for doctors, physiotherapists, orthotists, podiatrists, and hand therapists. If you'd like to know what OPC Health offers, visit opchealth.com.au and view their range online. G'day and welcome to the Aussie Med Ed, the Australian Medical Education Podcast, where we get to interview specialists in a variety of medical areas, asking their opinion on their certain conditions, obtaining their insight into how they diagnose and treat that condition. In these COVID times, it's a way of replacing a relaxed discussion around the hospital by allowing the listener to put forward questions to be answered or addressed on their behalf. I hope you enjoy the whole program, and welcome once again to Aussie Med Ed. And in this edition, we get to speak to Associate Professor Peter Smithen. Peter trained in the United Kingdom and then moved to Australia, where he worked as a complex revision arthroplasty fellow at the Royal Adelaide Hospital. He now has an appointment as a clinical associate professor at the University of Adelaide and the Royal Adelaide Hospital and treats both elective and traumatic patients and is heavily involved in teaching both the undergraduate and the postgraduate trainees. He's a colleague and a friend of mine, and today he's going to talk to us about hip pathology. Not only will this information be useful for the general practitioner seeing a patient on a regular basis, but also for the medical student revising for their exams or preparing for their OSCE examination. I'm Gavin Nyman, an orthopaedic surgeon based in Adelaide in South Australia, and I'm the host of this podcast. I'd like to begin this podcast by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land which this podcast has been produced, and pay my respects to the elders both past and present. It now gives me great pleasure to introduce Associate Professor Dr. Peter Smithen. Peter's going to talk to us about hip pathology and in particular hip arthritis. Welcome, Peter.
Yeah, thanks, Gavin.
Pete, can you tell us how you think about hip pathology and what main conditions you see as a practitioner in this area?
I suppose similar to how we try and teach the medical students, I try and break sort of hip pain and pathology into sort of three areas. So I break it into sort of pain that you find and feel in the groin, which normally links to pathology that's within the hip joint. And then pain that's on the outer side of the thigh, which can be usually extracapsular and muscular in nature. And then pain that's coming from the buttock or into the back, and that has sort of back pathology. I suppose 90% of my work or more is hip osteoarthritis. But I do see a bit of, well, failed hip replacements, but also for native joints, I'll see labral tears or femoral acetabular impingements. Hip dysplasia and sacroiliac problems are probably the most common things I see.
So what you're saying is that the hip pain is predominantly in the groin area and SI joint pain is felt predominantly posteriorly.
Yeah, that's pretty much how it usually works. Normally the hip intra-articular pathology, so hip osteoarthritis, there is some element of groin pain, although they will sometimes have pain that radiates around the side and the back as well. The main focus of the pain and the main pain that gets resolved after hip replacement would be that groin pain. The sacroiliac pain or sacroiliac arthritis or back pain are different. With sacroiliac, it's normally a little lower than general back pain and sort of starts off more at the inferior area of the sacroiliac joint. And there's a few tests that you can do to sort of differentiate between some of these symptoms that we do, you know, when we're examining patients. As you know, Gavin, one would for intra-articular, a good test is flexing the hip up and trying to internally rotate the hip joint and seeing if the pain is mainly focused in the groin, whereas the sacroiliac joint, the test that you would do would be flexion, abduction and external rotation and determine if the pain is more the back. And so it's quite important when you do these tests, not only to do the test, but also ask the patient where they're feeling the pain, not just do they have pain, to do those differentiations.
And does the age of presentation affect the diagnosis? In other words, does a different pathology more likely in different age groups?
The labral tears will often happen more in your younger adults or teens even, and the osteoarthritis presents later. Hip osteoarthritis has presentation in any age group, but the most common is from sort of 60 to 90 years old. And there's some studies showing within that age group, about 8% of people will have hip OA, and that sort of compares to knee osteoarthritis, where there'll be near sort of 12 to 14% of patients or people in that age group.
And does the incidence of osteoarthritis vary between females and males?
There is some sort of differences, but often we see sort of a spattering of both, to be honest with you, because we're seeing at the end stage for needing surgery. So there is slightly more incidence in females than males by about 1%. So I think they talk about hip osteoarthritis in males near sort of the high 6.8 or so percent in a few studies, whereas females is near about 8%. So it's fairly close, a little bit more common in females.
So I tend to think about osteoarthritis as being either primary or secondary, and the secondary causes being secondary to trauma or infections or other metabolic other factors. How do you like to subdivide osteoarthritis?
So I usually break them down in those sort of categories as well. I think some of the breakdown I do also relates to the age of the patient. So I would probably start off rather than worry about whether it's primary or secondary, but more on what age they present at, because that sort of changes what surgical options that I'm going to be more inclined to perform on a patient. So, for instance, in the older age group, I'm going to be going down and doing a hip replacement, whereas if they're a younger patient, I'd like to see if there's any other options I could do to salvage that hip joint and delay a hip replacement.
I believe there's a lot of pediatric conditions that can cause arthritis. What are the main ones you may see in real life? I've obviously heard about DDH and Perthes and slip capital femoral epiphysis, etc. Are they as common nowadays, or are they screening more or less common?
Unfortunately, they're still very common that we would see those. Hip dysplasia and late presentations of hip dysplasia are actually on the increase around the world, which is disappointing. So there's been some countries that are actually performing ultrasound on these patients to try and stop them getting missed hip dysplasia. The other one that I suppose out of the topics you talked about, the one that is missed is septic arthritis and the secondary consequences of hip OA following septic arthritis. And then we do see a spattering of patients with sickle cell disease, which present on to either ankylosis or hip osteoarthritis.
Obviously, sickle cell disease leading to avascular necrosis, then osteoarthritis secondary to that. Is that correct?
Yeah, that would be how it would go. That's right.
Now, years ago, I understand DDH was originally called CDH, or congenital dislocation of the hip. I believe they changed the names because they felt that some of the dysplasia could occur after the development of the hip. Is that correct? Is there other factors that lead to DDH? Or is it purely from an instability in the hip at birth leading to secondary arthritis?
No, I think the reason it changed to the developmental dysplasia is it's something that can change and be modified as the child and baby grows, and also modified within the changes in utero as well. So it's something that progresses over time. There does seem to be different incidences with different populations. For example, Caucasians seem to have this more commonly than Afro-Caribbean populations, for example. And one of the original thoughts of this change, and possibly a slight increase more recently, may be due to the swaddling that is done in some groups, whereas other groups will actually use their carry their babies on their side, keeping their legs in a flexed, abducted, external rotated position, which helps to try and reduce the dysplasia ongoing because the hips are sort of then located within the joint.
That's amazing. Do you think that's actually developed that style of carrying because of that, or just purely by chance?
I think it's purely by chance would be my honest view of that. I think it's an easy way to carry, and I know it's not the only reason. I mean, swaddling has been performed more for calming someone's child for while they're sleeping. So, I mean, I think that many people in all walks of life will carry their child in that sort of position. So I don't think it's sort of unique to a certain population or not. So that's one of the differences that was thought. The other main factors and risk factors with developmental dysplasia have been linked to firstborn females and a breech delivery and family history as well. So they're all the S, really. So unfortunately, it is on the increase, which sort of there's a lot of education and advice trying to actually identify this early, either whilst they're in hospital or with early screening as soon as they leave hospital. And I suppose the things that look at, if you were going to actually look at this further, would be to look at abnormal buttock crease signs, looking at whether there's an abnormal, when you're changing a nappy, whether one leg doesn't abduct as far as the other side is another good test to check. And then when they start to walk, be obvious of any subtle limps. But by that stage, it's quite a late presentation if you're only picking it up by that point.
So obviously, throughout the all stages of life, there are different areas that can develop arthritis. I know Perthes is more common in the later childhood, is that correct? And then slip capital femoris in the young adult or adolescents as they go through puberty?
Yes, those time sort of zones that we've all taught about at med school are still the same. So as you say, developmental dysplasia, you're trying to identify either immediately at birth or within the first few months. Perthes ranges from about 4 to anything up to sort of 10 years old, but the most common is between 4 and 8 years old, with a male predominance more than female. And then the slipped upper femoral epiphysis happens normally over sort of 10 to 12, 13 age group, and again, that's more in a male population.
Now, obviously, these are conditions that occur in pediatric age group and young adults. But I believe as the patient becomes a little bit older, there's greater chances of fractures and other traumatic conditions leading to secondary arthritis.
Yeah, I'd probably agree with you. Fractures probably the most sort of common one that we see as a late presentation or an adult age group. There are the sort of hip dysplasia, which are sort of variations of developmental dysplasia, but where the hip is not fully dislocated, but the hip joint is a bit more open. And so the joint actually isn't held as well. And that generates over time a lack of congruency between the joint and arthritis developing. And then you've got, I suppose, the other option where the cup is too closed and you get a cam and pincer type deformity, which is the CAD-CAM hip dysplasia or dysplastic nature, which can then go on to osteoarthritis as well.
How common is that? Is that thought to be the main cause of primary arthritis, or is it now just thought as another minor factor in the causation?
Yeah, I don't think it's thought of as the main cause. It is a cause, I think, rather than a main. There are, again, I suppose it's one of these that still is requiring further research to actually determine the true incidence. A lot of these things are asymptomatic and, you know, actually trying to, I suppose, change someone's management in the early days when they're asymptomatic to actually find these diagnoses, see how they progress. It's quite hard from a sort of a research point of view.
No, I know avascular necrosis is also a good cause of osteoarthritis. And I believe alcohol and drugs and smoking are other factors that can cause avascular necrosis. Is this a common cause?
I mean, it's not one of the main reasons that we see it. I think if you're going to talk about drugs, then steroid use is probably the most common one that it gets linked with. But again, it's the majority of osteoarthritis that we see, I would say, is primary osteoarthritis rather than some of these secondary osteoarthritis things that you're talking about. But yes, avascular necrosis and steroids would be the classic ones. At med school, we always talked about caisson disease, which was due to deep sea diving or getting high pressure experience on the body, which then creates these sort of nitrogen bubbles in various parts of the body that cause avascular necrosis of bone in this scenario where they get hip AVN. But it's extremely rare. It's not something that I would see on a day-to-day basis.
So in general, in summary, we're saying that the main thing you see is 90% is arthritis, of which perhaps 90% of arthritis you see is primary and unrelated to these other secondary causes. But to be a medical student needs to be aware of these conditions, as well as differentiate between other causes of hip pain, such as back pain or SI joint pain. That's normally localized in a different location in the body, or lateral as opposed to the groin.
Yeah, I think that's correct. The main thing for a medical student, I think, is to be aware of these, but also just be aware particularly of how the examinations are different between the different conditions.
Now, when you go to assess an arthritic hip, obviously we start with history and examination and investigations. What's the key history questions you would generally tend to ask in your clinic or expect a medical student to ask when they're assessing a patient for an exam, perhaps?
Yeah, so I would I'd break this down into sort of three elements, I suppose. One would be getting a excellent pain history. Second would be trying to get a really good functional history. And then the third would be just to trying to get a very good general medical history in terms of how safe they are to proceed on to surgery. The questions I want to know about pain are where the pain specifically is, where does it radiate to, what type of pain is it? Is it a sharp pain or a burning pain? Burning pain often linked more to nerve symptoms, where the pain radiates down the whole back of the leg, which would then link more to sort of sciatic-type symptoms, or whether it happens on certain manoeuvres, which may make me look more whether it's a label tear, or even if it, again, piriformis syndrome or something like this. And then I'd be asking, is the pain worse in the morning or at the end of the day after they've done a big amount of work? And then in terms of functional history, again, I suppose that's linked slightly to pain because you're looking at what functions are they avoiding, depends on what pain does this cause. But with a functional history, you're trying to find out if there's any locking or any feeling of instability within the hip joint and what activities would they really like to do. Because one of the things when we're taking all these histories is not only know what the limitation is now, but what really are they hoping to actually, the operation or the procedure that we can do, what are they really hoping to be able to do afterwards? Because you need to sort of either modify or focus on trying to achieve that for the patient.
And are the questions regarding general health and their fitness for surgery important in assessing the patient, perhaps in an exam situation as well as in real life?
I think they're really important. So with the elements in there, I'm looking at firstly their general health, and social factors. So one of the big factors for increased complications in hip surgery or any surgery is obesity and smoking. So trying to actually see these sort of, I suppose, breaking this down would be modifiable risk factors that they can deal with before any surgery and non-modifiable risk factors. And so if you, again, can break it down into those sort of two elements, you can hopefully provide some counselling and correct some of those modifiable risk factors before they're going to go on to any surgery.
And of course, it's always important to ask what treatment they've already had too, because the treatment of arthritis starts simple and then progresses to a surgical type path. But the main questions you'll generally expect a medical student to ask in the treatment plan, I mean, whether they've had physiotherapy or whether they've had use of aids or medications?
Yeah, so again, you hit the perfect three really there, isn't it? So you're asking them what medications they've been able to solve, what walking aids or activities have they used to try and change, and then what physiotherapy or alternative therapies have they tried? And so if you open them in those three sort of elements or those three questions, you usually get quite a good sort of picture from the patient of what they've tried before. And what they're willing to try if they haven't tried some of these things in the past.
And if we proceed to examination, what are the main steps you'd go down the path of? I'd like to let you know that AussieMedHead is supported by HealthShare. HealthShare is a digital health company that provides solutions for patients, GPs and specialists across Australia. Two of HealthShare's products are Better Consult, a pre-consultation questionnaire that allows GPs to know a patient's agenda before the consult begins, as well as HealthShare's Specialist Referrals Directory, a specialist and allied health directory helping GPs find the right specialist.
Yep. So, I mean, on examination, the first thing I'm doing is looking, I'm taking a lot of information in just from looking at the patient, either when they walk into my clinic or even just when they're sitting there. So I'm looking to see their general habitus and their general sort of demeanor, how much pain they generally are in just from the way they're standing or just moving within the chair or trying to get up out of the chair to undress for an examination. I'm also looking around the room to see what activities and what things they have, what their shoe wearing as well. And then when I go on to actually the physical examination, I start off by having the patient standing and try and look for any wasting of the muscles, any scars, plus any other deformities that are very obvious. Is there a driving deformity within the spine with, say, some scoliosis, or a driving deformity in the knee as well, with, you know, a very valgus deformity within the knee? And then I would perform a Trendelenburg test, which is a test that looks at the function of the abductors and allows me, if you do that before you do gait, it sort of gives you a hint of what kind of gait you're going to be looking for. So the most common gait you find in these patients is an antalgic gait, much more common than a Trendelenburg type gait. Then on when I get the patient lying in the on the bed, the first thing I look for is whether there's any obvious leg length discrepancy, and then I'll perform something called a Thomas test at this point, which allows me to determine if there's a fixed flexion deformity in that hip joint, because often there's a bit of a contracture within the hip, and that leg length discrepancy can be due to some of that contracture rather than an actual leg length discrepancy. Then the most sensitive test is the flexion and internal rotation of the hip joint, and asking them whether they have pain in the groin. And that allows me to sort of determine if the pain's of hip osteoarthritis. However, I want to check other things as well, such as a sciatic stretch test to see if they've got any pain anywhere else. But some of the other tests that I perform, I'd be pretty steered by what my history has already told me of what tests I need to use to exclude. So if they haven't given me any history of back problems or back OA or piriformis or cognitive bursitis, then I'm probably going to be less inclined to do some of those tests. So history steering some of those additional things in your examination rather than having to do every test under the sun.
Yes, that's an excellent summary and really does emphasise how important the history is in actually honing in on what you want to examine. I also put a lot of emphasis on Thomas's test as a very important test, despite it being probably one of the most simplest tests and one of the first tests that most medical students learn.
Yes, I mean, I think Thomas test is an important one. I think it's one that sometimes is sort of poorly understood. And I think the way to think about it is what you're doing is when you flex both hips up initially and put your hand under their back on the lumbar spine, what you're doing is trying to flatten that lumbar lordosis and lock the pelvis in that sort of flexed position by holding the one leg still flexed. And then when you lower the other leg, what you're, when the pressure on your hand starts to give, that's when the pelvis is moving more than the leg is moving. And that's sort of the threshold that tells you how much extension they perform on that leg. So it's quite an easy test to do, but you do need to understand the basic principles of how it works.
What role do you think about abduction or adduction or internal external rotation when assessing a hip?
From a medical student, I suppose it's less of a high yield sort of test to perform. From a surgical point of view, it is actually quite important. And what I mean by that is that a lot of the patients that I see have got quite severe osteoarthritis, and that can give them an adduction contracture. So they end up with quite a tight adducted leg. And this can give them some of that apparent shortening. So that, although we've talked about Thomas test giving a flexion contracture providing shortening, they can get an adduction contracture as well, which causes shortening. And so from a surgical point of view, it's quite an important one to do, not only to be aware of pre-surgery, but also whilst you're intra-op, some of your instability or some of the patient's instability afterwards and risk of dislocation can be increase if you leave a leg in some form of adduction contracture once the surgery is finished.
Going on to investigations, what investigations would you tend to do once you've made the clinical diagnosis of arthritis? What are your main investigations you go down the path of?
Yeah, so my main investigation, I would start off actually are the simple investigations. What I mean by that is actually documenting the patient's weight and height to try and give me a body mass index. There's a lot of evidence now showing that forming hip and knee replacements on patients with higher body mass index has a higher risk of complications following the surgery. And so there, it's an important test, I think, to do. Although we do know rapid loss of weight with gastric surgery in the short period can perform a patient into a catabolic state and still increase their risk of complications following surgery. It's something that I think is important to at least be aware of. And then from a diagnosis point of view, the next test would be going on to a hip x-ray, but I would be wanting a pelvic x-ray showing both hips at the same time. If they're younger patients, then I was not thinking of hip OA, then I'd be going for more complex tests such as an MRI, but I'd always start with plain film and go from there.
Once again, it emphasises the importance of the plain x-ray, because I know sometimes we hear people saying that an MRI will give us all the answers, but you may not need an MRI if the x-ray shows it from the start, and just also saves a lot of time and money.
That's absolutely true. I mean, I think a plain film and a great history and a good examination almost always gives you most of the answers, to be honest with you, for the majority of patients. And certainly it's a cheap and easy test to perform. And it excludes some of the scary things. You know, if you're worried about any tumours or various other things, a lot of that information you can get on a plain film as well. So that's definitely an important thing to do.
Are there any blood tests you might want to do at all in the workup?
Yes. I mean, so if I'm now decided that I'm going to do surgery, then I'll do a whole plethora of blood tests. These would, again, start with the basic ones to look at their general full blood count and how their sort of kidneys and the clotting are going. And then more specific ones that have been shown more recently to prevent complications would be actually looking at their nutritional status, so taking good history on that, but also looking at their ferritin levels, their vitamin D levels, their albumin level, as well as some influence as well. And if I've got any, in all patients, we also do a test for diabetes. But if they have diabetes, then I want to know how well controlled this is. So I'll be looking at HbA1c, which gives me a very crude sort of idea of how well controlled their diabetes is.
What are your thoughts on urine tests, looking for a urine infection? How important is to pick that up and treat that prior to considering a hip replacement?
I think it's an important test to do, but it's really important to do when they have a history and symptoms more than actually just a generic urine test of urinalysis. I think there's been some, although we do them and we do try and treat any that we find, if someone has persistent urinalysis that shows some organisms but is asymptomatic, then it gets to the point where we don't actually treat these and carry on with surgery.
What non-operative measures do we consider before considering surgery? Are there any other conservative options we can think about?
Yeah, okay. So if we were going to, I mean, we've talked about the three things that we've asked them what they would like to do or what we want to see if they've done before they come to me. So that would be walking aids, medications, and then alternative treatments. So I think it's quite important to try all of these and ideally also try and get them to lose some weight. We know about four times your body weight goes through each hip for each step. And so actually even losing a little bit of weight can actually equal sort of four times off that hip joint. So those are the things that I would be trying to encourage them to do. Yeah, using a walking stick, even simple things like making sure they've got a change of shoes to actually stop some of that loading on their hips, and then trying non-steroidal anti-inflammatories and some paracetamol, panadine, osteo are all sort of early treatments that they should try. And physiotherapy also can help to some extent. Although we know for all these treatments, as much as they're going to help reduce the pain and the symptoms, it doesn't actually treat the osteoarthritis. So eventually, unfortunately, this osteoarthritis does usually gradually progress. The question is whether it progresses at a rate that they still need the surgery.
And if we were going to go down the path of surgery, and we've talked about the hip replacements, the main option in an older adult, what about a younger person? What are the alternative options and how often are they performed?
Yeah, so it's a relatively controversial area in some ways, and you'll get many different views and different opinions. But in balance, you still have, if the joint itself is completely destroyed, then you still have hip replacement as an option. And an alternative option would be a hip fusion. This can be quite good for a certain group of patients. They often have unfortunately progressed about 20 or 30 years afterwards having some back osteoarthritis, but you can change and take down the fusion and do a hip replacement again at a later date if you want to in this group of patients. Other treatment options are hip arthroscopy for labral tears, and you can perform if there are problems with a cam deformity of the femur, for instance. And then in very young patients that have dysplasia, you can actually do a femur acetabular osteotomy, where you do an osteotomy of the acetabulum is the main one, called a periacetabular osteotomy, to sort of reorientate the acetabulum and make it the shape of the acetabulum a bit more flatter to actually take more of the load of the hip joint when someone's walking.
I believe these are fairly rare operations to perform. But the most common one by far is the hip replacement. If we go down the path of the hip replacement, there's different parts of the hip can be replaced. There's hemiarthroplasties and total hip replacements, and the cemented and uncemented. Do they all have benefits or disadvantages, or they're all basically the same?
No, they all have advantages and disadvantages, and different people will tell you different advantages and disadvantages with all these things. But the principle is you have a total hip replacement, as you said, and that's where you replace the acetabulum and you replace the femoral side, the ball. So the cup and the ball are both replaced. The advantage of replacing both is it does mean that when the patient is moving, that when the ball is moving, it doesn't wear out through the acetabulum to the same extent as a hemiarthroplasty. And a hemiarthroplasty is where you just replace the ball or the femoral side and leave the cup as a native joint.
And that's predominantly done in fractures, I believe. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's done in very old patients with hip fractures. This is usually done because it's a slightly quicker operation than a total hip replacement and usually has less risk of dislocation and various other problems that total hip replacements can have. Hemiarthroplasties can also now be done either as a single head or with two heads, called a bipolar, where you have a head within a head. The theory of this meaning that some of that movement happens between the two head surfaces rather than between the head and the cartilage. And we've got many hemiarthroplasties still in over 10 years. But the general consensus is if they've had a hip fracture and the patient is well and has a good mobility, then a total hip replacement is probably better than a hemiarthroplasty to be performed. And I think the Australian New Zealand Hip Fracture Registry and the British Hip Fracture Registry has a sort of hemiarthroplasty in the majority of scenarios and a total hip replacement performed in between sort of 20 and 30% of patients with intracapsular hip fractures.
And obviously hip fractures are a different kettle of fish in that they have a higher risk of complications in the post-operative period and are probably considered separate to a standard osteoarthritic patient. And I presume every patient needs to be considered on an individualised basis as well.
Absolutely. I think there's many factors to be taken into account with a hip fracture patient. Not only, as you say, that the bone itself has less poor quality, the reasons for why they fell and if they repeatedly fall needs to be taken into account and ideally optimized and prevented if at all possible.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of ground in assessment and treatment of osteoarthritis of the hip. The final question really relates to your main area, which is research, and where you think the future is heading for osteoarthritis of the hip in particular.
That's a good question, and I think there's a huge amount of research going on. If you want to break it into three areas, there is the preventative area for all osteoarthritis that's having some interesting research at the moment, trying to actually, can you actually inject something or give something to patients to delay or prevent the osteoarthritis? And I think there's a lot of work in that area. The second area would be difference in implants and different bearing surfaces, and there's some new changes that are happening just at the moment in this field in orthopedics, not only just with how they're put in terms of the approaches, but also in the different materials that can be used once you've done these, or with different materials potentially reducing risk of infection or producing the wear issue. And then the post-operative research or the rehab and activity, which can be both pre and post, is quite an interesting area. And a lot of companies and researchers looking at activity monitoring of patients. We know that a huge number of people are now wearing activity monitors in their general health, but linking that into their rehab or prehab activities to actually try and modify things or encourage activity and prevent either the osteoarthritis or the muscle wasting to occur, or to actually build someone up after surgery, are really interesting areas that is getting a lot of attention at the moment.
Excellent. Well, it's a huge topic. I really appreciate you coming on AussieMedEd, and it's really great being involved in having you on this and working also at the university together. So once again, I'd like to thank Professor Peter Smitham for coming on AussieMedEd. Thank you very much, Peter.
Thanks so much, Cameron. It's much appreciated.
The information provided to you today is designed to complement the information provided to you in your local region, and should supplement your readings and teachings in that area. Please don't take it as the only way of treating this condition or assessing a condition, but really as one of various ways of assessing these conditions. Please be aware that the information provided today is really just general medical advice and isn't designed to actually be a source of medical information regarding your particular condition. Remember to consult your specialist or medical practitioner if you have concerns about a condition raised in this podcast. Thanks once again for listening to our podcast, AussieMedEd, or the Australian Medical Education Podcast. We really enjoy hosting this podcast. I hope you find it useful to hear a pragmatic approach to everyday conditions. If you have any questions or information you want to ask about us, or you'd like to put a suggestion for a topic, please don't hesitate to email us at gavin@med-ed.com.au. Once again, I hope you've enjoyed listening to it, and we look forward to hosting it next fortnight when we introduce a new topic. Thank you.